Chapter 5. The War Years. Everyone who was an adult on that December 7th, 1941 day will remember exactly where they stood or sat when they first heard the news of the attack on Pearl Harbor. I was at our summer home on the south shore of Lake Superior that weekend. I walked from our cabin to our car, got in, turned on the radio, and the electrifying news poured forth. I was stunned, but I didn't know why. There had been so many warnings in the year or so before. The conflict had raged in Europe for over a year. Japan had been involved with China for several years. The fires were raging around us. How long could we stand aloof? So the mad dogs of war raged, and now we were involved. No one escaped having their life completely changed. When one tries to understand war, our minds just stop working. There just is no way we can understand it. Of course, back in the Middle Ages and before, war was not such a bad idea. The men waging war then were a bunch of fellows who couldn't find work at home, so they joined together and called themselves an army. That way they could get away from the wife and kiddies and have a lot of fun with the guys. Not bad. Then, too, there was the fun of sacking cities. But then war got serious, and the fun went out of it. We think back to Civil War days when long lines of men stood facing each other, firing at the men opposite them. Sheer madness. And years went by, and men no longer could see the men they were trying to kill, so they invented massive weapons, hurling death and mangling men miles away. Now we are seeing real progress. But came the 60s when young men began to reason out this thing called war and found no reason there at all. So instead of blindly following the call of patriotism, they began to use reason, and so possibly war could become a thing of the past. And it could be, except out there somewhere there might be a man or woman who could insanely push the atomic button, nullifying all reason and destroying all life on this planet. One wonders if the gods on Mount Olympus might not be shaking their heads over the stupidity of mortal men. But now the war had come, and we had to put all reason aside and work on this massive new project, manufacture the weapons of war, and enslave men and women in the military fighting machine. No life was left unaffected. The war hysteria was upon us. Local Japanese Americans were herded into concentration camps in the West. Their only crime was that they were of Japanese ancestry. That's hardly a crime, but in the madness of war, almost everything becomes an unpatriotic crime. Major Bose, a much-loved entertainer on Broadway, it was whispered, was a German spy, sending messages to the enemy through his broadcasts. No one checked rumors. They just believed them. And the war hysteria descended on us broadcasters, too. So we were ordered to go to the nearest police station and be fingerprinted and have our photo taken, police style. We went to the Duluth police station laughing and joking, but when we entered the station and came up with a stern-faced police sergeant, the laughter left us. He was bewildered and told us he never thought the day would come when civilians would come in there and ask to be fingerprinted. He told us of his first customer, years before, who was dragged into his office shouting and fighting. And when he got near the window, this criminal leaned out the window, yelling for help. Now we were here, so he dutifully fingerprinted us and took our photos. Where they went, I have no idea. And at this late date, I don't really care. The Coast Guard commandeered the boss's 30-foot yacht, a peaceful picnic sort of yacht he used to ply up and down the St. Louis River, into the bay, and on real peaceful days, maybe out into Lake Superior, but always keeping the shore in sight. How this sweet little ship was converted into a Navy fighting machine, I never heard, but it was returned to him after the war. All broadcast stations were ordered to reduce power 10% to save wear and tear on the transmitting tubes, and no tubes were available except as direct replacements for worn-out tubes in your transmitter. This after you had sworn on oath that the new tube was actually a replacement. Gasoline, tires, sugar, shoes, and what all were rationed, leaving you trading ration coupons with your friends. Suddenly, money was not important anymore. What was important were ration coupons. Gasoline coupons were dated, and after the expiration date, were worthless. One time, I showed up at the ration board with an expired gasoline coupon book with a few coupons still unused. This so dumbfounded the board that they gave me a new book with no questions asked. You just don't return unused coupons. Then I received a letter from Dr. W. L. Everett, who had visited me in Duluth some years before. He asked if I wanted to join a new research group he was organizing in the Signal Corps. Boy, would I join him, and I did. I was given the rank of major. I never went to basic training or to officers' training school. I left Duluth as a civilian and arrived in Washington as a major. Dr. Everett was a full colonel, and his second in command was my old friend from St. Paul, Lynn Smedby. He was lieutenant colonel. We did not bother to wear uniforms except when we were in a combat zone. If you were caught in a combat zone in civilian clothes, you were considered a spy and shot. If you were in uniform, you might still be shot, but the odds were in your favor. There were a dozen of us, all nationally famous engineers with PhDs attached to their names, and then there was one little country boy, and that was me. But Dr. Everett knew me, and I had earned a little reputation in my work in AM broadcasting, in shortwave broadcasting, in FM broadcasting, and in manufacturing broadcast equipment. I was in good company, even if they were not. Our office was in that fabulous new Pentagon building, which was air-conditioned when almost all the rest of Washington was not. Our desks were next to the office of the Chief Signal Officer, General Olmsted. Sometimes he would come out of his office and sit with us, getting away from the phone and people in his office. The Pentagon building was massive, and someone said 30,000 people worked there, and I suppose that was right. The place was overrun with people, and then there were those anti-aircraft batteries all around the building and all around Washington. They were manned around the clock with a crew of men always standing beside each gun. But I could not help but notice these guns were of somewhat small caliber, likely with limited range. If the enemy flew in at low altitude, they might get banged up. But at any altitude at all, the enemy planes would be very safe. But war material was so desperately needed on every front, and our country was just beginning to get into war production. And there were air raid alerts, where every light in Washington was supposed to be turned off, leaving the enemy no lighted target to hit. The first time, there was a surprise air raid alert at 2 a.m. in the morning. The air raid sirens screamed out their message, and everyone in Washington woke up and turned on their bedroom lights, wondering what was going on. The town lit up. The inhabitants were scolded by the newspapers the next day. And there were many nighttime air raid alerts after that, and if you were on your way to catch a train, you were stopped dead in your tracks until the all-clear signal came. And, of course, by then, your train had left without you. But then war is like that. Whoever said war was orderly. Meals were served in that massive Pentagon building in endless cafeterias where the prices were ridiculously low with quality of food to match, and they always had a 50-cent special, which included pie. But Ken Norton, standing in line in front of me, picked up the items of the special but decided not to take the pie, which was part of the special. At the checkout desk, the girl said, "That'll be 75 cents. And Ken said, "I want the special, but I don't want the pie." The girl said, "Well, then it's a la carte, and it's 75 cents. So Ken went back in the line, got a piece of pie, banged it down on the tray, and said, "Now what is it?" The girl said, "Now it's the special, and it's 50 cents. So was wondrous bureaucratic Washington. Did we work there? Oh, yes, we did. From 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., Monday through Saturday. That is when we were in the office. Much of the time, we were at research laboratories in Florida, at Bellmer, New Jersey, and even MIT in Boston. It was at the Florida Research Lab where much of the work was done. The Signal Corps had taken over a country club near Orlando, Florida, and there we had lots of instruments and room. Most of our research was in connection with this new thing called radar. It was so secret, that you were not allowed to speak the word outside the lab. And mostly, I guess we didn't. Radar was invented in England at the beginning of their war. They had erected massive towers on their south coast, and with crude instrumentation were able to detect German planes headed their way while miles away. This gave the English Spitfires time to leap in the air and be ready for the onslaught of German bombing planes. England had so few planes and men, they just could not be patrolling the skies. They had to wait until the last minute before springing into the air, mounting a counterattack. It is of these men and women that Churchill spoke when he said, "Never before in history have so many been so indebted to so few," or words like that. These few were able to so nobly function because of radar. So it was radar that we more or less concentrated on, looking for ways to make it more efficient so it would accurately detect enemy planes further away. One factor we gave a lot of attention to was a new thing called noise figure, which was the measure of noise generated within a vacuum tube, as well as radio noise from the sun and from outer space. One time, the Belmar lab sent an exciting new vacuum tube down to us in Florida. This new tube was so valuable and so new, it was sent down to us under 24-hour guard in a sealed room on a train. Breathlessly, we tested this tube and found it had a noise figure high above the average tube. It would have been better if we had let the enemy capture this tube with the hope that they would incorporate it into their new radar sets. But I suppose they had some sharp lads in their labs who would have discarded the tube just as we did. One of our group was that famous physicist, Dr. Ken Norton, who years before had developed radio wave propagation curves, which the FCC, even to this day, use in computing the coverage of radio and TV stations. I did a great deal of calculating under his direction using those old mechanical calculators, which was all we had before the modern electronic computers of today. Ken would write papers for scientific publications, which I tried to understand, but could not. One time I said to him, "I followed you halfway through the first paragraph of your latest paper, and then we parted company." Ken just laughed and said, "Don't feel so bad, Charlie. Sometimes I write a paper, lay it aside, and then a month later I pick it up and I can't understand it myself." In our group, there was Dr. Cutting, president of Colonel Radio and past president of the Institute of Radio Engineers. A brilliant gentleman with many droll stories. One sticks to my mind. This pompous old man was riding on a subway for the first time, disdainful of it all. He sat stiffly, leaning on his cane, when a little fellow sat down beside him. Presently, it began to smell bad around there. The old gentleman leaned over and said, "My good man, did you just break wind?" The little fellow looked up, more pained than hurt, saying, "Of course I did. You don't think I smell like this all the time, do you?" Then there was serious, courtly Dr. Carroll, who wandered into the office at 8 a.m. D-Day in Europe, and we were excitedly talking about this tremendous new development in the war. Dr. Carroll took the New York Times from under his arm, opened it, scanned the front page. No news about D-Day, so to him, there was no such thing. Haven't the Times always been the first with the most news? When the Times printed it, he would believe it. Then there was Arthur Omberg, a brilliant engineer from down south, a man who always kept copious notes. Rummaging through his notebook one day, I came across this. "Little people talk about people. Average people talk about events. Big people talk about ideas." Arthur, it seemed, was always talking about ideas. I ranged far and wide in calling on research laboratories up and down the East Coast and as far west as the Twin Cities. My clearance papers got me in any laboratory, and I carried a book of railway passes. I would write myself a railway ticket to anywhere and always be in Pullman cars. One time I got on the train in Florida, and in going to my bedroom in a Pullman car, found two young ladies already there. I was shocked, and I told them I was a decent, respectable married man, and they couldn't stay there. One of them had to go. They both went. I suppose they wanted to stay together. One of my trips took me to the Twin Cities, and I took a side trip to Duluth to see the old gang. The meeting was not a happy one. They did not think the war was a very serious thing and poked fun at me, a fat bureaucrat. Of course, I was on the road from time to time, but my 60-hour grinds in the office and in the labs did not give me the feeling that I was loafing through the war. The farther you are from a war, the less important it is. But to the man in a front-line trench, with the enemy just yards away doing his best to kill you, does sort of give you the impression that the war is a very serious thing indeed. One time, Bill Critchlow and I were in the Signal Corps lab in Belmar, New Jersey, and we had a shortwave receiver tuned to a station in England. An American soldier group was singing, "I'll be seeing you, I don't know where or when." This was before D-Day, and their voices faded in and out, as shortwaves do. And Bill and I stopped and listened, knowing that many of those voices were of young men who would not survive D-Day. Voices that haunt me to this day. "I'll be seeing you. I don't know where or when." It was an exhausting grind, and I was always tired. I remember one meeting with a British wing commander who talked to our group about communication problems over there. Before the meeting, I told him we were all always tired, and I said we likely would doze during his talk, but he would have to stay awake as he was the speaker. And I did doze off, chin on my raised up hand. I jerked awake and saw he was looking straight at me and was laughing. You can't win a war sleeping, and one really should stay awake. We were always involved with top secret matters, and we were constantly being tested. A strange military young man or woman would drop by our office to chat with us. We knew they were plants by the security forces, and we knew enough to say nothing. Then there were the young men soldiers who came by to empty our waste baskets, after which those papers were taken to the roof and burned. An officer always accompanied them. Then, as the war wound on, I noticed the young men were coming to us minus an arm or leg, the residue of war coming back from Europe, finishing out their enlistment at the Pentagon. The Pentagon was a vast labyrinth of rooms, halls, and stairways. One could easily get lost, and most of us did. Sometimes the only way we could find our office was to go outside the building, study the building, and then walk around to what we thought was the closest to our office. There were endless maps on the walls, but who could figure them out? Then there was the eternal story of the workman who got into that enormous ventilating system, could not find his way out, and was still wandering endlessly around looking for an exit. We didn't check these stories, we just believed them. We knew the atomic bomb was being developed. We didn't know much about it. We knew that enormous plants were being built with only small packages coming off the assembly line. We also heard stories of the building of these plants where a plumber would work on only one floor. If a pipe was to go from one floor to another, this plumber would just stick it in a hole in the ceiling, and another plumber up there would grab it and hook on. But the plumbers never went from one floor to another. Well, so were the stories anyway. Then, too, we knew that many of the top physicists of the nation had just dropped out of sight, and we attributed that to their likely working on the atomic bomb, which I guess they did. Then there was the friend of one of them, whom we found out had been accidentally exposed to radiation, and who shortly after died. War is a dirty business, but we did not become involved in the atomic bomb research. We only heard about it through the secret underground channels. I had a car there, but almost never used it. Gasoline coupons were so hard to get, I did not bother, except for a Sunday afternoon ride, maybe, but not for going to the office. Instead, I used the buses, as did everyone else in Washington. The Pentagon was air-conditioned, I guess the first and only office building in Washington at that time. We would be in a cool, comfortable office all day, and then when we left, we would walk out into that incredible heat and humidity of which Washington is so famous. And all through those almost 3 years, I kept on working for my boss back home. I was making plans for a new station or two and for rebuilding present stations. We all knew the war would end someday, and we constantly used the expression, "after the war," and planned accordingly. I designed a directional antenna system for the Someday news station in Madison, and I designed a directional antenna system for our Eau Claire, Wisconsin station. This was done laboriously using only slide rule and pencil, endless calculations over endless hours. This in my living quarters, which were not air-conditioned and were incredibly hot with temperatures of 85 or more in the middle of the night. One of my problems was perspiration dripping from my face onto the papers I was working on. This grind of all day at the Pentagon and all blistering hot evening resulted in my getting a nervous stomach. So I went to the doctor, and he said he knew all about cases like mine. He had a name for the ailment, which he said made up many of his cases. He gave me a prescription, which turned out to be a red fluid, a tablespoon of which I was supposed to take before every meal. It worked. My stomach quieted down at mealtime. Looking back now, I realize I was taking pure alcohol, dyed red. Outside of the Pentagon, no office or hotel in Washington was air-conditioned. On the extra hot days, the Washington offices would dismiss all employees and close down. How that helped employees was a little hard to understand, as their homes were just as hot as the office. But I suppose at home you could strip down to only a loose garment or two, something not accepted in prim Washington offices. For years after the war, the only hotel in Washington that was air-conditioned was the Statler Hotel. On my many trips to Washington, in those after-the-war years, I would try to get myself booked into the Statler, and often I was successful, but with the understanding I could stay there only 3 days. After 3 days, out you go. One time, I was there with a fellow broadcaster, and at the end of 3 days, we decided not to answer the door when the bellboy came to evict us. Instead, we would just throw dollar bills over the transom and stay inside. This might have worked, except those rooms had no transoms. Air conditioning had done away with the need for that ancient method of getting air into your room. I was at our Florida lab a lot through those years, and I got to know Florida summer and winter, but I've not been back to Florida since. I guess where you were during the war years left you with no happy memories, and you do not go back. Those were exhausting, unhappy years, and today when friends urge me to go to Florida, the automatic reflexes in me always seem to point me in another direction. I guess there never was a happy war.